Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 14, called The Forest of Enjoyment. And in the purport today, we'll see that it's not that much enjoyment. And it'll be verse 46, the last verse of the chapter. And then we'll go on to a different chapter from tomorrow on. The verse is too difficult to chant together, so we'll just do the word for word. I guess that's why it's not on the board. So you can repeat after me. Yeah. Anyone who? Idam, this, Bhagavata, by exalted devotees, Sabhajita, greatly worshipped, Avadata, pure, Guna, whose qualities, Karmana, and activities, Rajashre, of the greatly saintly king, Bharatasya. Of the great saintly king, Bharatasya, of Bharat Maharaj. Shishirara Gopinath ki. Anucharitam, the narration. Svastiyanam, the abode of auspiciousness. Ayushyam, which increases one's duration of life. Danyam, increases one's fortune. Yashasyam, bestows reputation. Svargya, gives promotion to the higher planetary systems. In between brackets, the goal of the karmis. Apavargyam, gives liberation from this material world and enables one to merge into the Supreme, the goal of the Gyanis. Va, or Anushnoti, always hears, following the path of devotional service. Akyasyati describes for the benefit of others. Abhinandati glorifies the characteristics of devotees and the Supreme Lord. Cha and Sarva, all. Eva, certainly. Ashisha, blessings. Atmana, for himself. Ashashte, he achieves. Na, not. Kanchana, anything. Parata, from anyone else. Iti, thus. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada ki. Devotees, devotees interested in hearing and chanting Shravanam Kirtanam regularly discuss the pure characteristics of Bharat Maharaj and praise his activities. If one submissively hears and chants about the all-auspicious Maharaj Bharat, one's lifespan and material opulences certainly increase. One can become very famous and easily attain promotion to the heavenly planets, or attain liberation by merging into the existence of the Lord. Whatever one desires can be attained simply by hearing, chanting, and glorifying the activities of Maharaj Bharat. In this way, one can fulfill all his material and spiritual desires. One does not have to ask anyone else for these things, for simply by studying the life of Maharaj Bharat, one can attain all desirable things. That's quite a promise. Purport. The forest of material there are some contrasts here in the purport, you will see. The forest of material existence is summarized in this 14th chapter. The word bhavatavi refers to the path of material existence. The merchant is the living entity who comes to the forest of material existence to try to make money for sense gratification. And now the analogy starts. The six plunderers are the senses, the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the touch, and the mind. The bad leader is diverted intelligence. Intelligence is meant for Krishna consciousness, but due to material existence, we divert all our intelligence to achieve material facilities. Everything belongs to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but due to our perverted mind and senses, we plunder property of the Lord and engage in satisfying our senses. The jackals and tigers in the forest are our family members, and the herbs and creepers are material desires. The mountain cave is our happy home, and the mosquitoes and serpents are our enemies. The rats, beasts, and vultures are different types of thieves who take away our possessions, and the Gandharvapura is the phantasmagoria of the body and home. The will of the wisp is our attraction for gold and its color, glitter, and material residence and wealth are the ingredients for our material enjoyment. The whirlwind is our attraction for our wife, and the dust storm is our blinding passion experienced during sex. The demigods control the different directions, and the cricket is the harsh word spoken by our enemy during our absence. The owl is the person who directly insults us, and the impious trees are impious men. The waterless river represents atheists who give us trouble in this world and the next. The meat-eating demons are the government officials, and the pricking thorns are the impediments of material life. The little taste experienced in sex is our desire to enjoy another's wife, and the flies are the guardians of women, like the husband, father-in-law, mother-in-law, and so forth. The creeper itself is woman in general. The lion is the wheel of time, and the herons, crows, and vultures are so-called demigods, pseudo-swamis, yogis, incarnations. All of these are too insignificant to give one relief. The swans are the perfect brahmanas, and the monkeys are the extravagant shudras engaged in eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. The trees of the monkeys are our households, and the elephant is ultimate death. Thus, all the constituents of material existence are described in this chapter. Om Agyanati Mirandasya Gyanagyana Shalakaya Shakshurum Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. What a contrast between the verse and Srila Prabhupada's purport. And very powerful purport it is. It's a summary of the whole chapter, but I think it's a summary of the whole material entanglement in the material world. He put it very nicely, strongly, and could be a little blunt at times, but he put it very, very clear, very nicely. So I would start with the translation, because actually there's quite a few points which are brought up in the translation, and also we will see the contrast. There's a huge contrast between what's spoken in the translation and Srila Prabhupada's take on it. So the first thing which is mentioned is hearing and chanting. So we know very well from our practice of Krishna consciousness that hearing and chanting is the basis of the process. It's the number two activities of devotional life, very much emphasized in the Krishna consciousness movement. So we really need to hear first from proper sources, Srila Prabhupada, Bhagavad Gita, senior devotees, spiritual master. We need to hear with our heart open deeply so that we can actually afterwards chant and speak and chant the holy names with a proper understanding. So hearing and chanting are the basis of the process of Krishna consciousness, and I would say in Kali Yuga they are really the two main processes of spiritual advancement. There's 9 of other processes which are mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Maybe some of you remember this beautiful verse. Shravanam Kirtanam. Smaranam is another one. And then after, Padasevanam. We try to do all of them. They're all important, but the emphasis, of course, is on Shravanam Kirtanam. We do Archanam as well, and the other are a little bit more intimate. It's talking about, of course, offering prayers, Vandanam, all of us can do. And Dasyam, and then Sakyam, becoming friends with the Lord, that's a high level. And then, of course, very high level is to be fully surrendered, Admanivedanam. That's very high level of Krishna consciousness. So we try to do all of them, and they're all very important and in our devotional life, but the emphasis is definitely on Shravanam and Kirtanam. So in this verse it says that devotees interested in hearing and chanting, which includes us as well, regularly discuss. So the principle of regularly, this is very important, to regularly discuss. So regularly means in a regulated way, disciplined way. So we have morning program, we have sadhana, we take vows, we have standards, we try to follow certain regularity in our hearing and chanting. It's not something that we do only when we feel like it, once a year or for a special occasion, but it's regular. Every day we try to hear and we try to chant individually and in group when we do programs, morning programs. Also when we do kirtans, like Harinam, that's a form of chanting together, and bhajans in the temple that devotees from the college have established very nicely. So there's many ways in which we can, put this into regular practice. Either the morning program, which is the very regulated, and then you have many other forms of regular hearing and chanting that within ISKCON, the temples, facilitate. Then it talks about discussion. So I thought discussing is interesting because many times we might become a little bit dogmatic or kind of, especially in the structure of a class and, very clearly defined methodology of presenting Krishna consciousness, our realizations, it becomes less of a discussion. It becomes more like somebody speaking and we all have to hear. And I think it's very important that we have at the end of the class some time for discussion to keep this principle of exchanging and everybody's kind of participating. Because in some other traditions it becomes so rigid that, somebody speaks and there's no question of question, there's no time for questions, you can't ask anything, there's no discussion, you just have to listen. And then it can become a little bit stifling. So here it says regularly discuss. So that means devotees discuss. They, in a more informal atmosphere, like a sangha meeting or istagosti, then the discussions are more open. In the class, it's a little bit more formal. Somebody speaks for half an hour, 40 minutes, and then questions. And then there's sometimes discussions, which are very nice. I think that's a very nice part of the class at the end, when devotees bring in their own realizations, ask questions, their doubts. And and then this discussion aspect becomes integrated in the class. It's not just somebody speaking, finished, and that's it. Then another aspect which is presented, of course, the discussion has to be, in the principle of sharing, dynamic, has to be, something dynamic and open. One has to be open to hear and be asked questions. Sometimes we don't like when somebody asks questions. We think, oh, is he kind of challenging, or is he like, starts to become like more a fight than a discussion. But I think, we have to be open to hear others, doubts or questions or even issues, whatever. Of course, you have to be able to put them in perspective. If it's not the right time or moment to have a major discussion on a particular issue, you can address the person, then maybe in a different forum we can discuss that and address it to the managers or the temple authorities. So the openness is very important. And then, of course, it talks about submissive. So this is very important. This is one of the ways in which we should listen. It's one of the characteristics. There's many other moods and attitudes that one should have when one is listening, but here it's mentioned submissively. So submission is very important. Submission doesn't mean blindly or you know that one loses one's intelligence. Submissive means it's with the proper mood, the proper heart, the proper consciousness. So it's not about being kind of like a robot or can't think anymore and you just have to listen and that's it. No, it's about being open in one's heart and being able to hear properly, being attentive. Then of course it's mentioned about the pure characteristics of Maharaj Bharat. So in other words, he wasn't just an ordinary person, an ordinary king. He wasn't even ordinary devotee. He was a pure devotee, exemplary devotee. And these pure devotees who serve the Lord in particular pastimes and missions, they are worthy of our, as it mentioned here, our praise, our remembrance, hearing about their activities, because it's the same as hearing about the Lord. The whole Srimad Bhagavatam is very much focused on that, on listening about the Lord's pastimes, but also about the Lord's devotees' pastimes in relationship to the Lord, or in this case, Maharaj Bharat's activities. So they're all auspicious. So we're talking about pure devotees. And we have to be careful. Here it's talking about praise, one hears and chants. So the praising of the activities of, so in other words, pure character, pure devotee, and praise is another word which is used. We have to be careful ourselves. Sometimes we become a little bit artificial and we glorify and praise each other in ways which are not proper. In other words, praise and glorification are really meant for the Lord and the pure devotees. And for ourselves, we can keep it a little bit more modest, like appreciation and, saying some nice things, acknowledging somebody's good qualities like that, but in a little bit more sober way. Sometimes in the past, we were a little too effusive about glorifying ourselves and praising ourselves, but we have to understand that praise and glorification are really kept for very exalted devotees. Doesn't mean that we don't appreciate and we don't say words of appreciation to each other, and I think we will appreciate it more if somebody says something more sober, heartfelt, genuine, honest, than something very big which doesn't really reflect the reality. It puts us in an awkward situation and puts that person also in an awkward situation, and it's not such a so much wanted amongst ourselves. So I thought this point is very important, that we try to make the distinction between appreciation and glorification in that very exalted sense. And then there's of course a description of all the benefits that one gets when one engages in devotional service, in hearing and chanting about the Lord or his devotees. So it's very tempting, it's very interesting for anybody, even those who are materialists who have a lot of desires. It says that you get so many benefits by engaging in hearing and chanting, like lifespan. Everybody wants to live a healthy, long life. That's the traditional blessing in Vedic culture, and I think in the West as well, we strive very hard to have long, healthy lives. We try, at least. It doesn't always work because of karma and lifestyle, but that's a desire everybody has. So lifespan and material opulences in general, everybody wants to have opulences. It's mentioned they increase, so it's tempting even for somebody who has material desires. Let's hear about the Lord and his devotees, let's practice this technique, this spiritual practice of hearing and chanting about pure devotees. One can become very famous, so we can even attract famous people who look for fame. There's a lot of persons out there who really want even more than material opulences, they want fame. And, the process of Krishna consciousness can offer that. It's mentioned here in the scriptures. And even promotion to the heavenly planets. People want to be good and be promoted after this life to a better realm, a better world. But it's always within the material context, material desires of a better life, more opulence. And then, of course, even those who want to renounce this world and merge into the Lord's existence and be liberated, who have still this kind of selfish desire of spiritual liberation in the sense of merging with the Lord, then even that is offered by the practice of devotional service. So it seems contradictory. How can one be practicing devotional service and at the same time have this desire? But even if one does have that desire deep inside, it will be fulfilled in the process of hearing and chanting. So he says, whatever one desires, you know, whether it's material desires, liberation, or even different types of, you know, spiritual devotional liberation, you know, all kinds of desires are there. And any desire, we can practice the process of hearing and chanting. And of course, if one has no material desires and no selfish, you know, liberation desires, if one wants to just please the Lord and be a pure servant of the Lord, and of course for them, it's the desire is the actual hearing and chanting. That's the nectar, the actual fulfillment of any spiritual desire. So this basically means that Krishna consciousness is meant for everyone. Everyone who has any type of desires can practice Krishna consciousness, can make spiritual progress, can achieve his desires. And of course, you can't promise too easily and say, you know, you become a devotee and you'll become a, you know, famous artist, singer, whatever. But you can say, you know, if you have those desires and practice Krishna consciousness, those desires may be fulfilled if the Lord wants. So there is no problem to be a devotee and have these desires and receive those blessings from Krishna and from the spiritual from the devotees. But in contrast to all this, in the purport, Srila Prabhupada makes a very sobering summary of the whole chapter and of material existence. Especially not to get distracted with all these, oh, it's no problem, then we can be devotees, you know, practice Krishna consciousness and have material desires. At the same time, in the purport, Srila Prabhupada makes a very blunt description of the material world. And, you know, ultimately, you know, we should purify all these desires. That's the whole idea of hearing and chanting, is that at one point you will want to purify yourself of any desire which is taking you away from Krishna, distracting you from Krishna, you know, is an impediment to get to Krishna. So as one becomes pure in Krishna consciousness, one will automatically, you know, review what are his priorities, what are his desires, is he desiring the right thing, is it compatible with my spiritual evolution, upliftment. So at what is okay at one stage in one's life may not be okay at another stage in one's life. So it doesn't mean that to have these desires are bad in themselves, but at a certain point in one's spiritual development, they might become detrimental. So at one point it might be perfectly okay to have opulence and have certain, you know, desires, responsibilities in society, and be very Krishna conscious at the same time. At another point in one's life, the element of renunciation, of, so you know, being more sober, renouncing certain pleasures or desires, might be more proper. So that's the proof of how advanced a devotee is, that he's able to actually practice Krishna consciousness in any situation, whether it's with opulence or, you know, with, you know, material desires, or without opulence and without material desires. You know, it can be practiced in any stage of life, of stage of spiritual evolution. So I just want to go over quickly on the purport, because it's quite, you know, there are quite some strong statements which are made, and maybe we can reflect a little bit on that briefly, and then we can hear some comments. So I'll go a little bit over the purport. So basically, it's a summary of the whole chapter, and Srila Prabhupada puts it very compact, condensed, and, you know, very powerful. So the first analogy is the six plunderers are the senses. the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the touch, and the mind. So basically for somebody who is materialistic and doesn't have the, you know, the purity or the desire to purify oneself in Krishna consciousness, the senses become like plunderers. Well, if somebody is practicing Krishna consciousness, whether he's pure or in the process of getting purified, then all these senses become one's, you know, assistants. You know, one can get purified by, you know, as we know, seeing the deities, you know, listening to, you know, Krishna katha, smelling nice fragrances of things offered to the deities, taste prasadam, you know, like that. So this is for those with a materialistic concept. Then the bad leader, so diverted intelligence. This is a very interesting analogy, comparison of how diverted intelligence is like a bad leader. You know, intelligence has a very important role because it guides us. It guides our senses. It should guide our mind, control our mind. So when the intelligence is not properly used, then it's really like a bad leader. You know, you're in a leader position in society. You're supposed to protect citizens, think of their well-being, you know, be as selfless as possible, you know. But if you become, you know, too much absorbed by your own, you know, position, power, control, things like that, then you lose the other aspects, and then you become obviously a bad leader. You still have that kind of power to influence people, but you're doing it in the wrong way. So intelligence is the same. Intelligence is meant for Krishna consciousness, but due to material influence, then we use it in very sophisticated ways to enjoy, to achieve material facilities. And I think the West is very expert in how to use material intelligence. We have a lot of intelligence, no question about it, but we don't use it necessarily in the best ways. So we use it just to create more material facilities, better material facilities, and it's not used properly. So it's like a bad leader, like a diverted intelligence. So everything belongs to Krishna. So he talks about perverted mind and senses. So the perverted minds and senses come from a diverted intelligence. So when intelligence becomes diverted, then the mind and the senses become perverted. So it's like diversion leads to perversion. Then the family members are compared to jackals and tigers. So this is a difficult one because, you know, family members, of course, we want to have a very nice feeling about them, whether we're devotees or we're not devotees, non-devotees. It's difficult to see them as, you know, being jackals and tigers. It's a difficult one to understand or to fully grasp. But in a materialistic setting, if there's no spiritual practice and people are very selfish and want to just, you know, obtain something for themselves, enjoyment, then that in a very crude way, that's what really happens. That the family members become like jackals and tigers. They just want to get something for themselves. And then the herbs and creepers are our material desires. So our own desires for material objects and pleasures are all these creepers and herbs that grow in gardens and in the fields that we don't want, but they're everywhere. They grow much quicker than the good things. Like, you know, sometimes I don't cut the grass for a few days and the grass barely grew a little bit, but then you have a creeper that is like huge, you know, became like 10 times bigger than the grass. So the creepers and the herbs, they just grow, you know, very, very strongly. The wrong desires can be very, very increased very strongly. Then the mountain cave is our happy home. So I guess the comparison is quite, the analogy is quite interesting because, you know, what is a mountain cave? Nothing special. So we think, you know, if we have a happy home, a nice home, you know, we're very proud about it. But in the comparison, it's just compared with a mountain cave where somebody can just go in and live. You know, so many animals take shelter in the caves, in the mountain caves, to protect from the rain and the wind and everything. So, you know, it's just compared with a mountain cave, nothing more than that. Then the mosquitoes and serpents are our enemies. So that's like a kind of a funny comparison, that from all the enemies, the mosquitoes and the serpents, they're always there to create trouble to the human being, to the living to other living entities. Then rats, beasts, and vultures are different types of thieves who take away our possessions. So we could get into who are the rats and who are the beasts and who are the vultures, because there's different types of thieves. You know, you have big thieves, small thieves, violent thieves, very organized thieves. So there's all kinds of thieves in our life that take away our possessions. But the analogy is just kept quite simple, that there are many different types of horrible animals that will, you know, snatch our belongings. And then, of course, the phantasmagoria of the body and the home. You know, we're completely convinced that this is the body is so great and our life is pretty good. Then the whirlwind is our attraction for our wife. And the dust storm, so the two, the whirlwind and the dust storm are connected. You know, the wife and the passion experienced by during sex. So it's really like a storm. You know, you're completely caught up in you know, blurry of, you know, dust, and you know, everything's kind of, it's like you lose any sense of where you are, what you're doing, what's happening. You're caught up in a very strong, in this case, sensual experience, feeling, and it's like a dust storm. I don't know if you've seen in the film sometimes, or if you've experienced yourself personally. Being in a dust storm, it just comes, and you know, you're like, it's like, you know, you're can't see anything, you can't do anything, you can't breathe. You have to, you know, it's like you're completely struck by the circumstances. So sex desire is a little bit like that. Once it hits somebody, it's you lose complete control of everything around you. Then, of course, the cricket is compared to harsh words spoken by our enemy during our absence. So that's the worst. You know, if somebody tells you something bad, I mean, later they will talk about those who directly insult you, but those who speak to you badly about you, not in your presence, everybody gets a really bad feeling about it, even worse than if they tell you, you know, personally. So they're compared to crickets. I guess crickets make a lot of noise. They really, you know, kind of disturb you when you hear them. And the owl is the person who directly insults us. So I don't know if maybe somebody can say something more about that. Why the owl? But I guess the owl also makes very strong noises. Impious trees are impious men. The waterless river represents the atheists. That's quite an interesting. I couldn't make so much the connection there, but I guess a waterless river is really useless. You know, to have a bed, the bed of a river without any water, it's really like, you know, really waste of you know, of space and things. So the atheists who give trouble in this world and the next, you know, those who really preach atheistic philosophies. And then meat-eating demons are the government officials. I couldn't really grasp the connection between the two. Maybe Maharaj could say something later about that. But I couldn't really fully understand government officials and meat-eating demons. But anyway, I guess. And then the pricking thorns are impediments of material life. That seems quite obvious. Pricking thorns are very unpleasant. So in our material life, in our life, we get all kinds of impediments. We have experience, big ones, small ones. So you have small thorns, big thorns. You know it's very unpleasant. And then this is something that maybe is also a little bit difficult to make the connection very clearly. Is the little taste experience in sex is our desire to enjoy another's wife. So basically, I don't know, my understanding is that even if there's some little material taste that one is, something that one is trying to obtain from sex, in a kind of negative way, let's say, in a materialistic way, is our desire to enjoy another's wife. In other words, that one is not satisfied with what Krishna has, given to him for material life, and one is thinking of enjoying somebody else's wife, somebody else's, giving somebody else's wife. A little bit like Ravana with Sita, it's like a perverted desire. You're not satisfied, you want it. There's a negative aspect to enjoying there. And the flies are the guardians of women, like the husband, father-in-law, mother-in-law, and so forth. So I guess it's comparing all these guardians, you might think they're so powerful to protect women, but they're just compared with flies. Who can a fly protect? I never saw the fly protecting anybody. So kind of comparing all these important material roles that people take, like husband, father-in-law, mother-in-law, to protect the woman, are compared with flies. So then it's not very solid. The creeper itself is woman in general. That's a difficult one to understand. Maybe somebody can give some explanation. The lion is the wheel of time. That one also is more like kind of a poetic understanding of time. And the herons, who knows what herons are? They're similar to the crows? But we don't see them around here. Crows and vultures we know, and they're compared with pseudo-swamis, so-called demigods, yogis, and incarnations. So that's quite clear. And all of these are too insignificant to give one relief. So that's the basic understanding, that even if some of these things seem okay, everybody's insignificant to give one real relief or real protection, because only Krishna or the pure devotee can give the soul actual relief from material suffering, from material entanglement. Everything else is very temporary or very precarious, could be destroyed at any moment, could be changed at any moment, very fragile. And then it says the swans are the perfect brahmanas. So it's the swans are the perfect brahmanas, not just any brahmanas, but the perfect brahmanas. Because a swan is considered the most, kind of opulent bird, most pure of the birds. And the monkeys are the extravagant shudras engaged in eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. That's also like an interesting comparison. The monkeys and extravagant shudras, not sober shudras, but extravagant shudras, which seems like a contradictory kind of combination in itself, because shudras usually are not very extravagant. It's more the people who have means and things. So anyway, so this is one other comparison. And the trees of the monkeys are our households, and the elephant is ultimate death. I don't know. And there's many of them that I couldn't fully, understand myself, and I wouldn't be able to explain them. So if any of you, here's the end of the chapter. Basically, this is the summary that Srila Prabhupada gives, which is very compact. If there are any further understanding of some of these comparisons or clarifications or experiences, realizations, maybe it's a good time to discuss about them. No, go ahead. So it's like a good image to represent. Okay, now it's finished. Poof. He's not going to look if he's going to crash, smash some little animal or insect. So death is like that, completely non-sentimental, let's say. So Maharaj? I think elephants, when they get angry and when they get mad like that, angry, they're like reckless. They destroy anything in their path. So here they didn't say mad elephant, but anyway, because you know elephants can be very, you know, they look very peaceful in general, but when they become angry and mad, it's like. So so we can think about mad male elephant, and it's like ultimate death. Chabadra? I didn't say that we shouldn't be argumentative. I said that submissive doesn't mean that one accepts everything or is one becomes like blind follower or blind listening. It means that one is listening with the proper mood and the proper, you know, heart. And if somebody says something wrong, then it's, you know, it's completely normal to address it, discuss it, you know. But you know, but maybe not with a challenging mood or with like, because you know, that's where the submissive means that you do things in the proper way. So it doesn't mean that you accept everything or that you follow blindly, but you do it in the right attitude. It's more a question of consciousness and attitude than you know, accepting everything and you know, sometimes, because that's like more military type of submission. You know, you just accept authority to do things and all the, you know, it's like the structures like that. But in spiritual life, in Krishna consciousness, submission means more, you know, when you hear somebody, you actually hear, you're trying to, you know, connect, to hear, to be able to listen. Doesn't mean that you accept everything somebody said. You might, you know, discuss it but arguing might be more like the negative side. Because it sounds, yes, you can argue and becomes like polluted atmosphere. Yeah, polluted atmosphere, you know. Yeah, so in other words, the ultimate submission is to Krishna, and submission to others is more relative. It's a different. It's not like, yeah, you don't have to be submissive. But I guess in this context, when we're saying submissive hearing and chanting, we're thinking about hearing from, you know, higher authorities, spiritual higher authorities, and especially hearing from the pure devotees. So when you're hearing from Srimad Bhagavatam, or you're hearing from, you know, the pastimes of Bharat Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada, then I think that level of submission, of course, is much more, you know, absolute, because there's no exploitation or no cheating propensity or mistakes in the sense of spiritual mistakes. When you have somebody who's not at that level, then of course you have to be more, it's more relative submission, because you can't have that same type of surrender or that same type of submission. It's a different level of submission. But I would say in that context, like what Jayabhadra was saying, is the submission is more a question of mood, in which you're listening to some, to each other and discussing. So it might not be so much submission in the sense of, like, you know, absolute truth and, you know, and conditioned nature or things like that. You wanted to say something? Sure. The elephant was compared with who? Death. Yeah, I guess in India, of course, this analogy is much more common, because they've had so many cases recently and in history of elephants just, you know, destroying whole places, and, you know, and so the people are a little bit bewildered, because on the one side they worship the elephant a lot, they use them for deity worship, and they like them and they respect them and they give them money, and then on the other hand the elephant goes mad and then destroys a village, kills people, you know. They become very, very aggressive when they lose it. So in India, I think this is a very more easily understandable analogy. Well, in the West, we don't see elephants so much. We don't get so much of a feeling of death when we hear of elephants. I think more of the zoo, you know, like something. Disturbing everybody. It's disturbing everybody. That's nice. The owl is compared to the person who directly insults us. So he feels it like that. When he hears an owl, he feels he's actually talking to him, making noises at him. So owls don't seem to be so auspicious. Yeah, the owl and the cricket is like, I guess the cricket is during the day and the owl is during the night, so it's a different type of continuous, non-stop. Just noise. I don't know. Yeah. These seem to be like cultural things, because in the West the owl is considered quite good, no? Like wisdom and all these alternative people, they have owls, you know, big collections of owls. But in India, it seems to be more negative. The Vedic culture, more. That is so where? Park, yeah. The white ones. Special. They make different noise, or here? White. Any other comments on all these analogies? Yeah, it's difficult. Yeah, Srila Prabhupada kind of, because it's the end of the chapter, so he makes the summary. But if you look at the verse from today, it didn't. There doesn't seem to be so much connection. Maybe it's a way of kind of blowing the bubble. Because when you read this verse, you think, you know, oh, it's nice, and you know, everything's compatible, Krishna consciousness and the material desires and heavenly world and enjoyment, and then you read the purport and it's like it's finished, you know. That's a difficult one. Meet it in demons. No, but this is not in the verse today. This is from Prabhupada is bringing somewhere. I didn't follow, you know, all the verses and all the classes. But you know, those of you who come regularly to class, then do you feel that all these analogies were mentioned? No, they were throughout the text. So you have to go back and try to find in the context. With a government official. It is quite common, especially in the days, that government people live towards other people. For example, when there is the crisis in Spain, and it's all over the world, Spain is very high in the same situation. So they are cutting everything, the people, salaries, more taxes, but the government employees. So, how many times it is also corruption in India, for example, is very big corruption. They have their connections, they build roads, and a family member is building that. So, basically, it is a living at the cost of others, which is compared like sucking blood and eating flesh of the people. Sounds the right mood here. Jabana? But I guess also in materialistic life, it's a question of degrees, in the sense that there might be some elements of this exploitation or feeling of being exploited, whatever. But it's not that it's absolute. It's like degrees of more people. If you saw it. It's true. Especially at the moment of death, you really see what's really in people's hearts and consciousness. No, yeah, especially here in the West, this concept of when you're giving or you're productive, there's some interest, and when you're not productive or giving, then the interest kind of goes away, and there's a tendency, not that everybody's the same, but there's a tendency to put people in homes and not have to worry and all these things. So I guess it's a question of degrees. The principle is there. It's probably everybody experiences to some degree or another. Some people it's more blunt and it's like overwhelming, and other people it's more subtle and less. But that, I guess, unless you're a pure devotee or really striving in Krishna consciousness, then some element of exploitation or, you know, deception is there. The last one. Let's go. For real? Fighting. So it's, you know, I think the tendency is there, that's obvious, but to what degree and how it manifests, it's kind of probably different according to the levels of consciousness. Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, getting out of this material world ki, Gaura Premanandi.